The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, because we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. Today we'll be talking about an issue of great importance to all of us. Our vanity. Many of us want to pretend that we're above this, but $45 billion in cosmetic sales a year in the U.S. tells us we're not. And men, don't act like you don't buy into this too. 15% of cosmetics purchases worldwide are yours. So here to tell us what cosmetics can actually do, as opposed to what their advertising tells you, is Paula Begon, the cosmetics cop. But first, some speaking up. And we're talking today about the amazing Meeting 8. I'm here with Jeff Wagg, Communications and Outreach Coordinator, and Austin Luton, the Press Manager for TAM8. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having me.
So the amazing meeting has been mentioned frequently on Skeptically Speaking, but I don't think we've done a real introduction to it. Who's going to tell us about it?
Well, I can do that. The Amazing Meeting is the annual conference of the James Randi Educational Foundation. James Randi is a retired stage magician and escape artist, and in his later years, he's decided to follow in the footsteps of Houdini, who spent quite a bit of time showing people that folks who said they were practicing real magic were actually just magicians like he is, or was in this case. And so Randi started an organization in 1996 called the James Randi Educational Foundation, and we spend our days trying to educate the public about critical thinking, especially about the paranormal and the supernatural. And once a year, actually more than that this year, but for many years, once a year, we would get together with hundreds and hundreds of like-minded folks and talk about skepticism and science and the search for the truth.
Brilliant. That's a wonderful way to explain TAM. So how many people attend every year?
I believe last year we had over 1,000. We're looking for another over 1,000 this year.
It's grown every year. We started at 150, and it's been our projection is this is going to be the largest TAM ever again.
And sorry, this is the 8th. So it is the 8th year of TAM, or did you miss a year?
It's the 8th year of TAM. It is the 10th TAM. That's a little confusing. We changed the time of year, so we had a mini TAM once, and we had one in London last year, so that brings us to 10. We actually have another one in London and in Australia later this year, but we're going to talk about the U.S. one here.
So who's on stage this year?
Every year there's a wide range of speakers, notable scientists, skeptics, authors, medical physicians, entertainers. So this year our keynote speaker is Richard Dawkins. He's a British zoologist who'll be delivering the keynote speech. Of course, we have James Randi, the founder of the James Randi Educational Foundation. Phil Plait, who blogs at badastronomy.com. Adam Savage from Mythbusters, and a number of other people.
So a lot of people who have actually appeared on Skeptically Speaking.
Exactly.
So there are also workshops and paper presentations as well.
Yes, the workshops have a wide range of topics from skepticism in general, basic skepticism that is. I believe Jeff is doing a workshop on that. Skepticism as it applies to the classroom, science and medicine by Dr. Steve Novella, who runs a blog, a Neurologica blog, about science and medicine and skepticism. We have feminism and skepticism, skepticism and sexuality, how to another workshop on how to create your own grassroots skeptic movement. So a lot of different wide range of workshops. The paper presentations are presented by the attendees of TAM, not the speakers or the other people who have been talking the rest of the conference. And this usually happens the last day of TAM. And the paper presentations are by the people who've just come to talk. They're not being paid to do this. They were just doing it because that's something they want to say and something they want to care about. And personally, I end up finding those to be the most entertaining, the most fruitful discussions from those paper presentations.
I've definitely enjoyed them in the past.
And many of them end up being speakers on the main stage later on. Now, you know, some of the people who've spoken of the paper presentations include Brian Dunning and Rebecca Watson and Tracy King, who has the stage in London sometimes. Sometimes the paper presentations, because they're on Sunday, are overlooked, but they really shouldn't be, because this is actually where a lot of the new thought and skepticism is coming from.
So I do have to ask, why Vegas? Because it's really not a location that's known for its critical thinking.
No, actually it isn't. However, it is known for its ability to put on a conference. And when it comes right down to it, it's a practical matter. Vegas is a very easy airport to get to from most major U.S. cities and Canadian cities. It's very easy to get from the airport to the hotels. And the way the hotels are set up there, it makes it much more affordable for us. For example, if we were to have the conference in Vegas, in New York City, where people have suggested, we would probably have to triple our price just to meet the extra expenses there. So while Vegas in July is hot and loud, and some people don't choose that as their favorite vacation spot, it actually ends up being one of the best places to have a conference. And that's really why we're there.
I would like to point out that I am paying $35 a night for my hotel room. American, but still.
But yeah, and that would be very difficult to do in New York. You might be able to get a parking meter and sleep on the street for $35 for a couple hours anyway.
So in addition to the things that you've already said, if you could give people one reason why they should be attending TAM 8, what would it be?
Boy, for me, you know, I started off as an attendee and now I work for the JREF because that's what an impact TAM had on me. It was the first time in my life I felt like I could just be myself among hundreds of other people that all were somewhat like-minded. These were people who all cared about the truth. And we might have different ideas about things, but we were all willing to discuss them and all willing to examine the evidence and have that dictate what we believed. And it was such an amazing experience. After TAM, there's this thing called the TAM High, where you go home just thrilled with life and the world because there are other people like you out there and they're doing things. So for me, that's the reason to go to TAM.
Top that, Austin.
I'm not really sure I can top that, but I do know what Jeff was talking about with the TAM High. That's precisely how I felt. Last year was my first TAM. If I could say that there was one really important reason to go to TAM, and it's because people are going to tell you that you're wrong, and a lot of times they're going to be right about it. And they're doing this not because they want to be a jerk. They're doing this because they actually do care. They want to make sure that you're as prepared to have an accurate view of the way the world works as they do. And it's a really collaborative experience, and everyone sort of takes care and watches each other's backs as far as rationality goes, and it's really great.
So where can people find all the details?
They can find out the details at randi.org, randi.org. And there will be a little banner in the upper left corner of the homepage, where it has the amazing meeting 8, and you can click on that and all of your dreams will come true.
Lovely. I'll see you guys there.
All right.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And now let's talk about one of the amazing meeting workshops. I'm here with K.O. Myers, founder of GrassrootsSkeptics.org, which is a resource center for people who want to start skeptical groups at a local level. Welcome back, K.O.
Thanks, Desiree. It's great to be back.
So you've organized a grassroots skepticism workshop.
Yes, we have. One of the things that we do at Grassroots Skeptics is to help people who are ready to take that step from being skeptics and are ready to move into doing skeptical outreach to help share their love of science and critical thinking with their communities. And so we're working with the James Randi Educational Foundation, and we put together this workshop that will help them, to arm them with the tools they need to start a local group, to build their membership, and to plan events to reach out into their communities and to help them spread their love of critical thinking.
So who is this workshop for exactly?
Well, the workshop is aimed at people who have come recently to a love of critical thinking and science, or have felt that way all along but sort of didn't realize how to talk about it. And one of the things that happens pretty consistently is people come to this worldview and then they want to find other people who are like them, and they are ready to reach out and sort of find other people to share their love of science and critical thinking with. And so the next step for those people is very often trying to organize a local group. It's also for people who maybe already have a group going, who are looking to build their membership, who are looking to learn how to plan bigger and better events so that they can reach out into their communities.
And what are some of the topics that you'll be talking about in the workshop?
We've got 2-hour-long sessions planned. The first hour is all about starting and growing a group. How do you find people to start your group? How do you build new members? How do you get people involved? The second hour is all about programming and events. Once you've got a membership base, how do you start reaching out into the community, throwing events that will attract people and bring in new members, but also turn new people on in the community to a love of science and critical thinking?
And this is all very practically focused.
Absolutely, yes. The idea is that it's nuts and bolts, it's how-to, it's very much you come into the workshop and by the time you leave, you're ready to go start a group, to go build members, and to go throw fabulous events.
And this takes place on Sunday, July 11th, and people do have to pre-register. So where does one go for more information?
They can get more information. They can see the panel lineup at our website, which is grassrootsskeptics.org, and they can register for the workshop, or they can register for the entire slate of workshops that the JREF is throwing this year at randy.org.
Thanks, KO.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm joined by Paula Begon, the author of The Beauty Bible and Don't Go to the Cosmetics Counter Without Me. The latter boasts over 1,000 pages of product reviews, ingredients research, and beauty myth debunking. Welcome to the show, Paula.
Thank you, Desiree. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being here.
Sure, my pleasure.
So since your first book, which was called An Exposé of the Cosmetics Industry, you've
actually
written...
My first book was called Blue Eyeshadow Should Be Illegal. I mean, in 1984, I wrote my first book. I had been in the cosmetics industry working. I had owned my own business. I had worked behind the cosmetic counters. I had worked as an esthetician, and I sold makeup at department stores, makeup and skincare. And then when I moved to Seattle, I got a job as a reporter and at Cairo TV here in Seattle, Washington. And what I learned working in the cosmetics industry and what I learned as an investigative reporter, I thought, it sounds like a book. I know how the cosmetics industry lies. I know how they trained me to lie. And so I wrote my first book called Blue Eyeshadow Should Be Illegal. And since then, I've written a total of 18 books on the cosmetics industry.
So 18 books seems like a lot of beauty myths, really. Is there that much?
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. This current book, Don't Go to the Cosmetics Counter Without Me, the current one is 1,000 pages. It actually could have been, when the typesetter was laying it out, because it has about 130 product lines, major product lines. And by the time we got to the S's, it was paging out at, you know, the Shiseidos and the, you know, those kind of product lines. And the S's, it was paging out to 1,700 pages. And then we thought, oh my God, we have to and it ended up being 1,000 pages. And then we put the rest of the product lines that didn't fit when we started cutting and created the website Beautypedia. So yeah, it's astounding. How many products, how many relaunch, and the endless claims about getting rid of cellulite, getting rid of wrinkles, getting rid of acne. Every new product line is more natural than the last, the next, you know, anti-wrinkle miracle. You know, it's endless. It earns me a living. It's endless because they're just crazy. They're the cosmetics counter people say crazy things. The fashion magazines say crazy things. They fib. They all fib and kind of straighten out the fibs from the truth because, you know, there's some brilliant products out there.
If we could find them.
I help you find them because you can't discern it on your own. That's just not humanly possible to figure all that research and all that detail out on your own. And what you end up doing is getting seduced by claims and you believe that particular company, but not the other company. And so, yeah, that's my job as the cosmetics cop is to help you stay beautifully informed.
Well, where do you think that comes from? Now, you did mention the media, but do you think people kind of innately have ridiculously high expectations about what cosmetics can actually achieve?
I think we have high hopes, to say the least. I think a woman's need to be beautiful and feel beautiful and look beautiful at just about any age yes, genetically, almost from very young, when we dress up our baby doll, to, you know, very old. I do charity work at some senior citizen homes, and the desire to be beautiful just is very potent and a significant part of our ego and identity. So yeah, we have high hopes. I think we give up our intelligence at the cosmetics counter because of that deep-rooted hope that the next product will be the next thing we do, the one we heard the celebrity use, the one our friend swore was a good product. High hope gets us every time. And then the media, the cosmetic companies through marketing and advertising take advantage of that.
Well, the marketing is phenomenal.
It's and it's crazy. I mean, the anti-wrinkle product they launched last year is still selling, and then they launch another one with even bigger claims but didn't stop selling the last one. You kind of wonder if this is – it's making the same claims. It's the new miracle. How come they don't say, oh, yeah, don't buy that last one. Buy this new one. And shouldn't it only be one product? You know, 20 products to get rid of wrinkles. You can't use all of them.
Well, let's actually talk about some of the language that they do use in those marketing campaigns, because it's not just hyperbole that's the problem. They use a lot of very sciencey sounding words.
Yes. Yeah.
So what does hypoallergenic mean?
Well, that isn't even the latest crazy scientific words they use are growth factors and stem cells and electric, you know, the electric charges in the skin that communicate cell growth. I mean, the scientific stuff out there is way past hypoallergenic, but hypoallergenic is one of those never-ending words that I think Clinique first started using back in the 60s or 70s to lead you to believe that that product you were buying would be less allergenic, wouldn't trigger allergy. And what was false about that is that one is that there's no standard as to what is considered allergenic or not allergenic for a consumer. Not everybody is allergic to the same things. You might be allergic to a dog. I might be allergic to a cat. Allergies are not something that have anything actually to do with skincare products unless you know your particular allergy. And as it turns out, as the cosmetics industry has gone along and more plant extracts because of the natural craze in cosmetics are being used, if you are going to be allergic to something, given 80% of the population has allergies to plants, that is likely to be one of the more possible allergens in a product. But again, it's all very individual and there's no standardized testing that is recognized by anybody in the industry, more or less by any medical board or, FDA or anything. So it's a made up term. It's not regulated. I could slap it on. I could slap it on your forehead. I could make you hypoallergenic. So it's meaningless. It's meaningless in the cosmetics industry.
Well, you mentioned the word natural as well.
Well, that's so ubiquitous. Natural, organic. I mean, there are about. Are you ready for this? There are over 15, and they're popping up more. I mean, probably as I'm saying this, there's probably now more than 20 different companies, different organizations that say they'll certify your product as organic or natural, that you could use their certification based on some list of things they say they will check out. And for most of them, it turns out that they just send you something in the mail. You check it off, you send it back, you pay them $1,000, and you get their certification. And then you have to renew it every 3 months. Now, it's not to say that there isn't benefit in some natural ingredients. There are. There's no doubt that there are a wealth of beautiful ingredients in the plant world, in the mineral world, and the, you know, products that come straight from the earth. But what it takes to get a plant out of the ground, clean it off, get the bugs off, make it ready to get into your product, stay stable, so when it's in your bathroom, it isn't a fungusy, bacteria-ridden, moldy mess. You know, think about how long a head of lettuce lasts in your refrigerator. It's not so natural anymore. And sure enough, when you kind of read between the lines of what the industry says about their products, when you look close, most cosmetic companies are hardly all natural. And even the ones that are using ingredients that are natural but bad for skin. Just because it's natural doesn't make it good. You know, peppermint, alcohol. Alcohol is hardly a health food, but that shows up in lots of natural products, actually, products that aren't so all natural or don't claim to be natural. And all, you know, menthol, eucalyptus, camphor, all of those are natural, but they're highly irritating to skin. When you irritate skin, you cause collagen damage, break down collagen, you stimulate oil production, which clogs pores. So irritation, whether it's from a synthetic ingredient or a natural ingredient, is deadly for skin. But they, so natural doesn't tell you anything. One, about the benefit of the product, also doesn't really tell you the exact nature of the product. It's not like you can eat that skincare product and have lunch.
How about dermatologist tested? Does that mean anything?
Sometimes it does, but what often happens is, actually, I would say 99% of the time, we see that claim, dermatologist tested, and we call every company whose product we review. That is standard for our protocol. What do they have to say about their product and their research? And in almost every instance, except a handful of companies, like the exception is Olay and Neutrogena, which is owned by Procter & Gamble. And I'm sorry, Olay is owned by Procter & Gamble. Neutrogena is owned by J&J, Johnson & Johnson. So there are a handful of companies that when we call and say, so you say it's dermatologist tested or it's clinically tested or it's tested by lab, show me the study. You know, because without knowing the protocol of the study, you don't know how valid it is. Mm-hmm. And other than that, I would say that of the 400 cosmetic lines we've reviewed, I can count on one hand the number of times I've actually seen a study, or the studies I have seen often aren't valid in terms of the expectation of what you hope the product will do.
How often do cosmetics companies actually do their own research, or do they pull from other people's research?
That's a hard statistic. I don't know the answer to that. I know that there's a lot of research going on out there, some brilliant research. I prefer, when I do my reviews, to use independent research. I would say most of the major companies are doing research. The Estee Lauders, the Olays, the Procter & Gamble. The question always is how, what is the standard of their research? Because if it's not published and I can't review, or a consumer or anybody can't get their hands on the study, it's hard to know, even if they are doing research, what is the meaning or the value of that research. Because if you take a product and I put it on one side of the face and I put what they often call a placebo on the other side, one that doesn't contain whatever miracle ingredients they're claiming, and they go, oh, look, the side with the special ingredients look better. If it's not done double blind, which is a fancy way to say nobody knows which side is getting what, or single blinded, meaning only the researcher knows what's going on the face, you know, it doesn't really tell you much, you know, because it's not scientifically done. But even more so, let's say it was really scientifically done and the side with their special ingredients did great and the side without any special ingredients did not so great, it still doesn't tell you about the thousands of other brilliant ingredients comparatively how they would have done. Right. So in other words, if I tested a green tea extract or a pomegranate extract on one side of your face and the other product didn't have anything, okay, maybe the side with the antioxidant, that's what green tea and pomegranate extract provide for skin, and it did better than the one that didn't have anything. What if the other one had had some other group of antioxidants like vitamin C or some of the more active forms of vitamin E or a different form of green tea? One of the things they're doing are designer antioxidants where they take the active antioxidant out of the plant. The active antioxidant in green tea is an ingredient they called ECGC, which is epi-something galactonate. It's a long name I never remember. Maybe that would have done better. So do you see what I mean? It's like, so even if the research is there, it doesn't necessarily have much meaning in terms of how you should choose a product.
Now, we actually have a question from the chat room.
Can we really expect people to be able to navigate a study on cosmetics and all the requisite biochemistry? That's from Greg Fish in the chat room.
No. No, absolutely. No, it's taken me 30 years. And even I have my limitations, and it's what I do for a living. I mean, I even give presentations to dermatology and cosmetic chemist groups. And, you know, even, I mean, we all have, I mean, it is heavy duty science, and not even all the scientists get all of the stuff around it. It's a, you know, as they say, it takes a village. No, lay people to understand research is very, very difficult, not to mention it's expensive to get your hands on a full study, even when it's published. Like, for example, one of the journals we use a lot is a free radical journal and an antioxidant journal and a cosmetic dermatology journal. Those three journals are almost $2,000 a year. And that's just three journals. We also, you know, subscribe online to a journal service so we can get individual studies we want to see in full for a reduced fee. I mean, it costs us thousands of dollars a year to do research. So one, it's almost impossible to decipher it just from a biochemistry or a physiology point of view. But it's expensive. It's just expensive to get your hands on it. So no, that's what I do for a living. I'll help you either through my books or beautypedia.com or cosmeticscop.com to get a handle on the information about what is going in products, not the fear-mongering that you get from a lot of sites where they choose a handful of ingredients and say, oh, those are the evil ones, don't use those, which still doesn't tell you much about, one is that often those the information they use isn't true, or it's, you know, using, you know, misinterpreting research or using one minor study, you know, with an ingredient fed to rats and say that extrapolates to putting it on the skin. So that's what I do. I help navigate you through the research and what exactly is going into a product. Because, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of brilliant, beautifully formulated products you should get your hands on. And the idea is to not waste your money on the products you should stay away from. Let me give your audience just one really quick blanket way they can start saving money. Well, actually, not wasting money is probably a better way to put it. And that is never buy a product again, a state-of-the-art product, one that's making claims about taking care of your skin, that's in a jar. Desiree, now you're supposed to ask me why not a jar.
Why not, Paula?
Funny you should ask. So all of those beautiful state-of-the-art ingredients, the antioxidants, the good antioxidants, the potent, what they call cell-communicating ingredients, like ingredients like vitamin A that can absorb into skin and tell skin cells to behave better and stop behaving like old cells and start behaving like young cells, niacinamide, which is a B-complex derivative, same thing, tells cells to start behaving like normal cells. All of those state-of-the-art ingredients don't like air. When you take the lid off of a skincare product and you stick your fingers in you not only let the air in from the environment, which starts to, they're air sensitive ingredients, they start deteriorating upon exposure to air. And when you stick your finger in, the bacteria that enters from your finger further breaks down the ingredients. No more jar packaging. Even if it's badly formulated, it doesn't matter one way or the other. But if it's beautifully formulated, a jar package is just silly. It's just a waste of money. You're getting little to no benefit shortly after you open it from the great ingredient.
Audience, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're here with Paula Vagon, author of The Beauty Bible. If you have a question for Paula, email live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So you mentioned that there are ingredients that people just consider evil as a group.
Yes.
Are there any that you would just never use in anything?
Yeah, there are. So in terms of the myth, the ones you hear the most about that are lies about their being bad is probably ingredients like mineral oil. Mineral oil is not an evil ingredient. In fact, research is pretty clear that it's probably one of the better wound healing, moisturizing ingredients out there. There's absolutely no research suggesting that the kind of mineral oil that is used in skincare products is a bad ingredient. It's a shame that this has gotten such a bad rap from the natural skincare companies, making you afraid of it, because as a result, you don't see it as often in products, and it is a brilliant skincare ingredient. But what the natural companies won't tell you is about the plant extracts that are bad for skin. And because there's no information around it, in fact, you don't see negative information about almost any plant that grows that gets included in skincare products. We end up using, for example, and think it's good for our skin is something called essential oils. Essential oils are ingredients like bergamot, ylang ylang, cinnamon, linalool, lavender, eugenol. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Or irritating plant extracts like I mentioned before, peppermint, menthol, eucalyptus, alcohol, grain alcohol. It's not the cetyl alcohols and the sterile alcohols, but those are just fatty acids, benign acids that happen to have an alcohol ester molecule structure attached to it. It isn't a grain alcohol. You know, think about martinis versus emollients. All of those ingredients like alcohol, the denatured benzyl alcohol or ethanol alcohol or lavender oil or bergamot oil, essential oils, are all irritating to skin. They inflame skin. Essential oils, the way they release their fragrance is a volatile action that interacts on skin and causes collagen breakdown. It's inflammation. There is an entire area of research about aging that's actually called inflamm aging. Wish I had invented that term. It's a great term. Anything that inflames the skin, whether it's the sun, whether it's irritating skincare ingredients, you end up doing nasty things to the skin. So whether it's natural or synthetic, if you irritate the skin, you are damaging it. And so I worry about irritating ingredients or anything you do to the skin that irritates it, including sun damage.
Are there any substances that consumers would be surprised to find included in their makeup?
Desiree, this is going to floor you. A cosmetic chemist, on average, and this changes obviously all the time, has over 20,000 ingredients that can go into a skincare or hair care product. Can you imagine 20,000? It shocks me all the time, these molecular structures and formulations and combinations of ingredients that go into skincare products. I think the silliest one that shows up repeatedly, well, not repeatedly, but on and off, is probably oxygen. Oxygen is 20% of the environment. You go much over 20% oxygen, and it's actually deadly. Hyperbaric boost, you can stay in for a small amount of time, and then it actually starts causing damage. It's not good for you. So often these cosmetic companies, to lead you to believe they're giving oxygen to the skin, use an ingredient called hydrogen peroxide, just like the stuff you buy at the drugstore in a brown bottle. Hydrogen peroxide, one of the ways they judge free radical damage is the formation of hydrogen peroxide. It's a potent radical. It's a potent free radical. It's one of the ways they determine what's damaging skin, and that's what they're sticking in your skincare product. Now, not many companies do that, but a lot of the spa lines that say they're giving you fresh air. I mean, it's just, one is that it's not a very stable ingredient in skincare products, but nonetheless, it shouldn't be in there.
Paula, so, I now see why you have written 18 books.
And it changes every year. The latest one is the stem cell thing. I mean, the claims are all over the place, but they're using apple, some stem cell from an apple, a special Swiss apple tree that they're sticking in skincare products and say they have evidence that it stimulates stem cells. So my joke about it has been, is that if it's an apple stem cell, apple stem cells make apples or apple trees. If you put that on your skin, are you going to turn into an apple tree? Is it, are you going to have like branches growing out of your face?
Are we honestly that susceptible to sciencey sounding words? Like that's all you need.
Yeah, we are. And the language on the ad sounds so good. And on the infomercials, they're so enthusiastic and they're wearing white lab coats and people are cheering. Oh, and it's, and of course that there happen to be thousands of product lines all doing this. My big question is how does any woman choose which one to get sucked into? So yeah, I know. I earn a living.
Well, there are a couple that are used that there is some validity to, like BHA, for example. So what is that?
Yeah. In the form of salicylic acid, I have a very strong leaning toward this ingredient. Some of it is personal opinion and a lot of it is research. There is a good deal of research and just personal experience that we all have that when you exfoliate skin, you get the dead skin cells off of the surface of the face, because one of the things that sun damage causes is an abnormal buildup of skin cells on the surface of skin. Sun damage causes a thickening of the outer layer of skin and a thinning of the underlying layers of skin, collagen destruction, and an abnormal growth of skin cells on the surface that should shed naturally on their own, but they can't because of the sun damage. When you put an exfoliant on, like a chemical exfoliant, like salicylic acid, you get an incredible, even, gentle exfoliation of the skin. The reason it's gentle for salicylic acid is because salicylic acid is related to aspirin. Aspirin is acetyl salicylic acid. Aspirin is an analgesic. It's an anti-inflammatory. So salicylic acid not only exfoliates, but it retains some of aspirin's anti-inflammatory properties. And one of the unique aspects of salicylic acid, not only does it exfoliate on the surface of skin, but because it's lipophilic, which is a fancy way of saying that it gets through oil, the fat within the pore that's clogging a pore, it also can exfoliate within the pore. Pores have cell lining, skin cell lining, that can get thick. That's one of the things that chokes off a pore. When you can exfoliate that cell lining within the pore, you can open up a pore and help get the oil out to unclog a pore. That makes it one of the more powerful unsung ingredients in the cosmetics industry, and it's cheap. It's not an expensive ingredient to formulate with. It's a tricky ingredient to formulate, but its benefits when it's not with other irritating ingredients, unfortunately, a lot of companies that sell salicylic acid products include alcohol or menthol or peppermint, which is just ridiculous because that adds irritation. Irritation actually, this was a fascinating part of the new beauty Bible that I wrote a couple of years ago. There's actually research now showing that when you irritate skin, it stimulates receptors within the pore itself that stimulate androgens. Androgens are the male hormone that create oil production. So you are actually, by irritating skin, inflaming skin, actually stimulating oil production, more oil production directly in the pore.
Which is precisely what we don't want to do.
I know. So yeah, salicylic acid, I think, is one of the more brilliant unsung heroes in the cosmetics industry, particularly for oily skin. Now, alpha hydroxy acids in the form of glycolic and lactic acid, we know the most about those, also have an incredible amount of research about their benefit for exfoliating, actually even stimulating collagen production. You know, one of my best analogies for the benefit of exfoliating, Desiree, have you ever gotten a pedicure?
I have.
You have? And when they say, do you want me to exfoliate your heels? Do you ever say no?
Never.
You want them to scrub that crap off.
Absolutely.
Like to the bone. Because when they do that and then put a moisturizer on, how do your heels look?
Like a baby's bottom, my
like
friend.
Like a baby's bottom. Now, heels get thick and callous for different reasons than the face. But the same benefit of getting those dead skin cells off, and then for your face, putting a brilliant moisturizer on loaded with antioxidants and ingredients that tell skin cells to behave better, you got one of the better combinations of skincare that the cosmetics industry can offer.
And we have another question from the chat room.
This is from Goddess Geek. Is there any non-prescription product that really helps with sunspots, etc., like some of the Retin A or other products that dermatologists prescribe?
Goddess Geek, that is like the best handle I have ever heard. I love it. Goddess Geek. I got to remember that one. So, yes, there are. Retin-A and Renova, the active ingredient in those prescription medications, and there's many generic versions, is tretinoin, which is an incredible medical ingredient drug that tells skin cells to behave better. But vitamin A, the whole vitamin A molecule, which tretinoin is a derivative of, it's a part of the vitamin A molecule, tretinoin. But when you put the whole vitamin A molecule on the skin, in skincare products, it would be called retinol, R-E-T-I-N-O-L, or retinol palmitate, R-E-T-I-N-Y-L, palmitate is P-A-L-M-I-T-A-T-E. There is research, and there's other forms of retinol too, but those are the ones we know the most about. When you put those on skin, they actually convert into that form of tretinoin, not as high a concentration, but when used on a daily basis, you do get some amount of that benefit on skin that helps tell skin cells to behave better. And one of the things you're telling them to do is not make bad skin cells, which is brown discoloration. The other thing is you have to use a sunscreen. You have to be neurotic, crazy neurotic, insane, pathologically dedicated 365 days a year to using a sunscreen. I know it's up there north, but given we're on the internet and it's like all over the world, if it's daylight, you're getting sun damage, and the bad rays of the sun come through windows. So, and I particularly for the hands, but even for the face, I prefer titanium dioxide and zinc oxide, some amount of that to be the active ingredients in your sunscreen, because they do the best of interrupting sun damage. That will help an immense amount. And then the other ingredient that I don't know if it's legal up in Canada, the active ingredient would be hydroquinone, which has a lot of research about it being effective. But I don't know if you could get that up in Canada. I'm not 100% sure.
We have many listeners in the United States.
Hydroquinone, which over-the-counter can show up in 1% and 2% concentration, have an immense amount of research showing they're beneficial for interrupting increased melanin production. The other ingredient that's quote-unquote natural, if you will, are high concentrations of vitamin C, particularly in the form of magnesium ascorbyl phosphate, but almost any form of vitamin C has some amount of research showing its benefit for improving skin discoloration, just improving skin in general. But the major ones would be sunscreen and some form of vitamin A. And actually, you know, I take that back. Even any product loaded with antioxidants, you're going to get some amount of benefit with sunscreen and retinol probably being at the head of the class.
And we have a question submitted via the website.
Paula, I'm a longtime fan and user of your products. I know you've previously wrote about the fears associated with chemical additives and preservatives in cosmetics and skincare, namely parabens. Do you have any new insights on the subject? That's from TJ.
I do. There were a couple of studies most of the studies about parabens, the scary studies that you've been hearing, are not associated with any causative effect, meaning if I see parabens in a human being, we know they do anything. The only research we've seen is where you know a causative effect is when they feed it in large body weight dosage ratios to rats. Now, I could feed a rat just about anything in overabundance. I could feed it too much water. I could feed it too much salt. I could feed it too much shellfish, and I'm going to hurt the little guy. So a lot of that research is animal studies. That's number one. Number two is a very recent study that was very impressively done. I know the university where the research was done. The researchers, the scientists that were working on the study. And it turns out that when a paraben is applied to skin, the way it breaks down through the body, it no longer has estrogenic properties. I thought that was fascinating. So it seems that parabens that do show up in skin probably get there from your eating it, because parabens are a food grade preservative. They're actually originally derived from raspberries, which is kind of interesting. So it seems that one is they could be there because of eating raspberries. The raspberries would break down and donate parabens to the body. If they are in the synthetic form, which are used as a food grade preservative, could have arrived that way, but it is unlikely that it arrived through any topical application. And even if it did, again, there's no causative relationship to what that means if parabens are showing up. By the way, lavender is estrogenic, and there is a little bit of research, not a lot. There is a little bit of research showing that lavender actually, for men, when they wear put on too much product with lavender in them, actually can get secondary female characteristics. They're estrogenic. And there are a handful of studies in the literature showing that applied to skin, they stay estrogenic and they're a problem.
Noted.
How do you like that? So much for natural.
Audience, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking. If you have a question for Paula Bagan, best-selling author of 18 beauty myth debunking books, email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we explore the predictions and the problems of transhumanism. We're joined by science blogger Greg Fish and George Dvorsky of the Institute of Ethics and Emerging Technologies. How will advancing technology affect our lives, our society, and even our bodies? How much can we really know about the future before we get there? And on Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong, Greg Layden looks at some common misconceptions about human evolution. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and we're here with Paula Bagan, and we have a bunch of listener questions.
This is from the chat room, from Fi Guy. Are there any anti-wrinkle products that actually work? I noticed the ads say they reduce the appearance of wrinkles.
There are no anti-wrinkle products that work the way we wish they would work. There are no anti-wrinkle products that replace cosmetic surgery. There's no anti-wrinkle products that replace Botox that even work remotely, like dermal fillers, like anything we hope would keep us out of the cosmetic dermatologist's office. Those products are lying. However, as I mentioned before, when a product doesn't come in a jar and is loaded with brilliant antioxidants and brilliant what they call cell-communicating ingredients, ingredients that can tell a skin cell to behave better. Another set of ingredients that there is a lot of research about is a group of ingredients called, they go by many names. Skin identical ingredients is one we use to describe them. This is a group of ingredients that mimic the structure of skin. So when you look at your skin, and right, it's a big organ that's all connected. You know, all of the skin cells are connected to each other. And if it wasn't for these ingredients, think of skin cells as bricks. And the mortar that holds them together are these substances in skin. And because of sun damage, because of age, because of menopause, we lose these substances that hold skin together. So when you stick in a skincare product these substances that hold skin cells together and give it back to the skin, that's an incredible, powerful combination to help skin behave, quote unquote, like younger skin. And then along with that, with an exfoliant, that's a good 1-2 punch, but again, it against wrinkles, but it just never quite lives up to the claims that we wish would happen, when we buy it and think, oh, that's the one for anti-wrinkle. I can't tell you the number of people I say, they'll say, so does this anti-wrinkle product work? And I say, well, you're using it. Did it work? And they'll say, well, no, but I thought maybe you knew. I said, well, you know better than me. You're using it and you didn't see a difference. So there are products that absolutely can make a difference. It's just we usually end up disappointed because it's never like the claim on the label.
Well, they do use the term miraculous.
They use this fancy science language and lifting and firming and anti-gravity. And I mean,
Do they use the term anti-gravity? Really? We've come to that.
That's a set of Clinique products. Wow. Yeah, anti-gravity.
Okay.
Isn't that good? I think it's very clever marketing. I think some of these names are just brilliant. And of course, there's the spa lines that, want you to believe that if you zen out or, relax, all of a sudden your wrinkles will go away. I mean, the marketing for these products, just, they're endless. They're endless.
We have another question.
This is from Barbara Drescher. Are there any downsides to using the powdered makeups that seem to be easily breathed in?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So I think, it's funny, the mineral makeup craze came up because, well, one is talc is mineral, by the way, and it's actually kind of interesting. The ingredient used in the original mineral makeup, which is an ingredient called bismuth oxychloride, is actually synthetically derived. It, no one's mining it out of the ground and sticking it in products. I mean, it's not bad that it's synthetically derived. It's just not as natural, actually, as talc, which really is mined out of the ground and stuck in products. Talc is related molecularly to asbestos, and that sounds very scary. You breathe in talc, oh my God, it's like breathing in asbestos. Ironically, bismuth oxychloride molecularly is related to arsenic. So, I mean, I could scare you about bismuth oxychloride as much as I can scare you about talc. Either way you look at it, you shouldn't be breathing in powder of any kind. So it is one of the reasons I tend to not like recommending loose powder because it does fly around. And yes, you should not be breathing in that stuff. It isn't even that great to use because it's messy. I mean, it is messy to put your makeup on that way. It's less easy to control than a pressed powder. So yes, I don't like the idea of inhaling any form of powder, which is why I recommend only pressed powder. You pick up the powder on the brush, only brushes, you knock the excess off, and then you apply it, and it is absolutely, and there happens to be no research showing that women who use makeup or skincare products for that matter have any more incidence of anything in terms of lungs or actually any disease, even cataracts or glaucoma. Women don't have an edge one way or the other. Men, it's all kind of equal depending on the disease. For, breast cancer, guys don't get breast cancer. Women get breast cancer. Guys get prostate cancer. Women don't get prostate cancer. So, but other than that, there is no association between makeup and skincare and any incidence of any disease. But in this case, for loose powder, you just want to play air on the side of safety.
And we have another listener question.
In the James Bond movie Goldfinger, a character...
Boy, that's going back.
Yeah, a character was killed by being completely covered in gold paint. The explanation given was that the paint suffocated her skin. Does our skin actually need to breathe, and is there any makeup that can affect pores in a similar way?
I love our listeners.
I have no idea, but I doubt that. Because when you're... I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh. Any question is valid. I actually don't 100% know the issue of what the gold paint, if it was really gold paint, what it would do to somebody's body. However, we know that if I put you in water, if I submerge you in water, which is in essence suffocating, there's no oxygen down there, right? If you drown in water, you're drowning because you're not being able to breathe. So there's many things I can think of where, you know, your skin isn't going to get oxygen and you're not going to die as long as you are snorkeling. You know, you got a snorkel or a scuba pack on and can get air. So I have no idea really what the gold, you know, that was fiction, but I know that when you're in water, you're not drowning. Your skin, if your skin is covered with water, your head's underwater. As long as you get air to your lungs, you're alive.
You gave that the old college try there. That was
But I don't know 100%, but just logically, it sounds improbable. And no makeup is that occlusive.
Last question. We are almost out of time. If you could debunk that one biggest beauty myth, what is it?
That dry skin and wrinkles are associated, or aging is related to wrinkles. Depending on the research you use, 70 to 90% of the wrinkles we see on the face are as a result of the sun. All you have to do is compare the parts of your body that see the sun on a regular basis to the parts of your body that don't. Just look at your forearm. Look at the difference between the top part of your arm and the under part of your arm. The part of your arm that sees the sun all the time is far more damaged and older looking than the parts that don't. Sunscreen and sun protection, being sun smart, is the best anti-wrinkle product on the market.
Brilliant. Paula, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Desiree. It was a kick, and I love the name of your show.
Thank you. You can check out Paula's work at cosmeticscop.com. And if you're one of the winners of Paula's book, you'll get an email from me after the show. Remember to visit us at skepticallyspeaking.com. There are links to our Facebook page, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks, all the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who, I don't think you understand, it's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless, let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore, just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
On Skeptically Speaking, we discuss a wide range of skeptical and science topics with a variety of experts. But I'd like to remind you that you, yes, you personally, are invited to join us on air every week for Speaking Up. Because let's face it, outreach is a part of skepticism. We all do it, whether we're talking to our parents about why they shouldn't buy into that multi-level marketing scheme, explaining the misinformation around vaccines to our coworkers, or forwarding that Snopes entry on why typing in your PIN number backward on the ATM machine does not, in fact, summon the police. But if you want to take your skeptical activism one step further and reach a broader audience, we're here for you. Do you have an event coming up that you'd like to promote? Or maybe you're a blogger that's been doing some great work and you'd like to talk about it? Or you'd just like to get some experience speaking publicly on a science or skeptical topic? What better way to get some real-world practice than on a friendly, rational radio show? If you're ready to have your say, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put Speaking Up in the subject line, tell us a bit about what you'd like to discuss, and we'll contact you to set up your very own 10 to 15 minutes of on-air goodness. We're looking forward to hearing from you.